from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the 1950s when the medical community began to make serious strides in the way we treat traumatic brain injury. The introduction of intracranial pressure monitoring ushered in the beginning of a kind of modern era in this field. Up until then, the mortality rate after traumatic brain injury, or TBI, was high. Rehabilitation was rare. In the 1970s, researchers began laying out what they call primary and secondary brain injury. The 1990s saw the development and the dissemination of standardized guidelines for treatment of TBI, with protocols for a range of issues, including drugs and management of pressure. So, where are we today? This hour, we continue our dialogue on disability, and I've got a couple of guests who are going to tell us not only about what they do, but about some of the strides we're seeing in this field, and I want to welcome them now. Paul Akers is the Vice President of Community Services for Epilepsy Prelude, Inc. Paul, great to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. And we have Kyle Hauser of Hauser Associates. Kyle, thank you for being here.
You bet.
Hauser Associates does what?
Hauser Associates, we do primarily traumatic brain injury. And I basically do evaluations, what we call neurobehavioral evaluations, and also see some people in talk therapy following their injury.
Listeners, if you know someone who's had a traumatic brain injury, maybe a friend or someone in your family, if you have questions about it, we'd love to hear from you this hour. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI. Paul, I'm amazed at what can be done in this field. I have one of my very, very good friends survived a remarkably terrible accident going back almost 13 years now. It's amazing. And I'm amazed at what can be done in this field. I imagine you are too.
Well, yes, I am. I think we're a lot of the community services that we provide are really kind of in the wake of a lot of the medical breakthroughs that had happened. Probably Kyle can tell you better than I can, but in the last, like in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of medical breakthroughs, as you kind of mentioned in your opening. And as a result of that, a lot of the community services, we were noticing that people were surviving a lot longer and they're at a higher rate, and therefore there were a lot more folks to be able to support in the community and to be able to reintegrate into the community once they were done with their short-term rehab. What is really also amazing from the community resources standpoint is that in the 90s, there weren't a lot of services in the community for people with brain injury. And a lot of folks were ending up in nursing homes or psych EDs or even out of state. And because we recognized that there were a lot of folks that were kind of falling in between the cracks and not getting the services they needed, and they were ending up in institutions, a lot of people, especially family members, were able to get together and say, you know what? This isn't acceptable. We have people, we have family members moving out of state, and we want to be able to keep them here at home. And so the New York State Department of Health created a traumatic brain injury waiver, which actually created community resources for folks to be able to stay in their community of choice and live with dignity, where they wanted to live and whom they wanted to live with.
Let me ask Kyle, and I don't, this is not meant to be a sort of a negative question. I'm curious to know, it's remarkable the change that's happened in this field since the 50s, the 70s, what we've seen in the 80s and 90s. Where do we still need to go? I mean, are we approaching a point where we're doing the best that can reasonably be done for a human being with a brain injury? Or are there still gaps that we need to fill in terms of what advances may be on the horizon? Mm-hmm. What do you think will be 25, 50 years from now, what might be different?
Very good question. Very good question. We have come a very long way, especially since the 70s. There's much research that goes on either at the bench level with animal models of injury, going all the way to the human studies. What has brought the awareness to the fore just in the last decade are two things. One, the whole sports concussion piece, which concussion is a brain injury. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's one, and of course the blast injury that occurs from IEDs in the wars that we've been involved in the last 10, 15 years. That is a different type of brain injury. So really what's going on at the research level at the forefront is, and let me pick up on the blast injury, is can science come up with a in-the-field diagnostic for brain injury, whether it's, you know, I stick something in your arm, we do something, some quick blood sort of analysis to see what's going on. That's certainly important from that perspective. We're also looking from the, and this is being generated from the sports concussion area, is can we do that on the field, okay, or on the mat, or wherever the person happens to be injured? There are some clinical indicators and a series of questions that are utilized to be able to assess that. And so we have some, so we're looking for a diagnostic marker that's quick, that's, you know, it, like in strep infections, a rapid strep test, something like that for brain injury. The other pieces may be in terms of after the brain injury, in terms of rehabilitation, will we be able to integrate technology in the, you know, within the brain? Will we be able to come up with a variety of different medications to slow the secondary process that takes place? You know, you have the primary insult to the brain, but then everything gets out of whack in terms of where blood should be in the brain and mm-hmm. where it shouldn't be, et cetera. And there's a lot of secondary injury that occurs in minutes to hours after that. Will we be able to develop medications to slow or cease that process in essence, have even better outcomes than we have now? So I think that's the forefront.
Yeah, there's really something very interesting about the whole diagnostic piece as well. And Kyle and I have approached this. When we're trying to determine if somebody has a traumatic brain injury, there are kind of two schools of thought on this. One school of thought is, okay, I look at an MRI, you know, an X-ray of sorts, and I'm able to determine, yes, this person had a brain injury based on that picture. There are other folks who say, well, the MRI isn't always going to show whether they have a traumatic brain injury or not. And so it's basically, you know, if they're showing the symptoms of a brain injury, then we still want to be able to treat those symptoms and treat it like a brain injury. And, you know, it walks like a brain injury, talks like a brain injury, it's a brain injury regardless of what the MRI says. So I think as we're moving forward, like Kyle said, as we're able to diagnose these more carefully and also where the location of the injury is, our treatment is going to be much better.
We're always in the media looking for, well, what are you going to get done in the next 6 months or a year? And research and development takes time. But it sounds like you both would be surprised if, at least in a generation, we don't have a better diagnostic in the field test. Would you be surprised if we didn't have that?
I would be surprised if we didn't have that, yes. I think that will be one of the major major findings for us. I think the and again, the integration of technology within the brain will be of interest. You know, there's, you know, our scanning capabilities are getting better. But again, sometimes the best diagnostic tool, when you don't see anything on the, I wish I had a dollar for every time I've read a record that said CAT scan normal. Okay, CAT scan screen, okay, MRI is better. Functional MRIs are even better than that, but we have some other scans there. But a very important, besides neurology, there's people that we refer to as neuropsychologists. They are trained both in the neurological aspects of the brain, and they're trained in clinical psychology. And they're able to do a variety of different, use a variety of different well-standardized instruments, pencil and paper types of instruments, and be able to look and administer these to a patient and figure out, what is easy for this person now, and what is difficult for this person? You know, they've got to be the archaeologist. They have to try to reconstruct that past. What did this person do mm-hmm. prior to? How were they functioning, and how are they different now? And oftentimes, a good neuropsychological evaluation by a good neuropsychologist will be a very early indicator of, there's some things going on here we really need to look at. And so they're a very important part of the diagnostic team, along with MDs that specialize in this area.
And we are very lucky in this community to have a lot of good neuropsychologists who do evaluations, mm-hmm. So a lot of helpful reports from them.
Mm-hmm. Let me get to the phones. In studio are Kyle Hauser of Hauser Associates and Paul Akers of Epilepsy Prelude as we talk about the advancements and what's available, and we talk about traumatic brain injury. This is Mark in Pittsford. Thanks for calling, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi, everyone. Great show. Thanks. Several years back, there was a show on public TV, I think it might have been on Nova or one of the others, about this topic. And there was the establishment of a certification for hospitals for traumatic head injury. The point was the first few minutes, as one of your speakers said, is so important. And I lost track of that, and I know there was a certification program or a designation program for hospitals. I'm wondering if your speakers would remember that and could enlighten me on that.
Well, from the outpatient perspective, there is a CARF certification, Certified Outpatient Rehab Facility. So I'm certainly aware of that from the rehab perspective. Sort of brain injury sort of divided up into three sections. If you have a brain injury at this moment, you're going to likely, you know, through auto accident, et cetera, that you're likely going to be taken to a level one trauma center. That would be Strong Memorial Hospital here, or your closest ones are Buffalo or Syracuse. Of course, you would be there for whatever period of time was needed. If you're in coma, you might be there even longer. And then sort of the second part of brain injury is certainly the rehab perspective. And, of course, the Brain Injury Rehabilitation Unit, formerly St. Mary's, now over at Park Ridge Hospital, funded generously by the Galisano Foundation. That's where people then go through intensive occupational speech therapy, physical therapy, neuropsychological evaluation and support, et cetera, and receive a lot of education. And then the third phase is, of course, when somebody goes home and has to resume, if they can, the rest of their life and live as somebody who's maybe a bit differently abled. And so there are certifications. I am familiar with the CARF certification. There is also certification for individuals that work within the field. Again, this isn't a hospital certification, but it's an individual certification, certified brain injury specialist, certified brain injury specialist trainer, of which I am.
Well, this was the first one.
Okay.
The traumatic accidents, car accidents and such. And the program I watched followed this doctor around in a during a couple of days and all the cases he dealt with. But the point was that the first few hours is so important. And not only that, but the monitoring of the patient in the first 24 hours after, you know, they get out of the ER and are in intensive care, there's a whole lot of advances made of what goes on regarding what goes on during that time and the brain swelling and all that. I just can't remember the certification it was or the name of the doctor that they were following.
Yeah, I don't remember either. What's interesting in your comment, though, Mark, is what really has improved over the time is this kind of compartmentalization of brain injury treatment. In the past, there was the medical piece, so somebody would have a traumatic brain injury. They would go into acute care hospital. They would treat them. And once they were done treated, they may or may not have surgery. And once that was done, then they would go over and the baton would be handed off to a short-term rehab. Mm-hmm. And they would stay for a period of time until they plateaued or until they were ready to be discharged. And then they would go out in the community. And there wasn't a lot of collaboration between those three pieces. A good example of this is a personal story I have. My mother suffered, had a brain injury. Back in the 90s, had a burst aneurysm, and she was in a coma for a while, and when she came out of the coma, she was speaking French, and my mother had never spoken French before, and it was one of these amazing things. My brother was there, it was his turn to be with her, and he went to the doctor and said, you know, is she really speaking French? Because she's never spoke French in her whole life. And he said, well, that's fluent French. I don't know where she learned it, but she's speaking fluent French. And the interesting part about the story was that they ended up doing a surgery, and they repaired the aneurysm. And when they were all done, the doctor was so pleased. He says, you know what? She's cured. This is just amazing that we were able to fix this aneurysm. It's really a miracle. And so we went in thinking, okay, this is great. So we walk in to the room, and we see our mother with this huge scar on her head. Her head is shaved, and she's still speaking French. And they're ready to send her to rehab and then prepare her to go home. And she wasn't prepared to go to rehab or to go home. But from the doctor's perspective, I did my job. That doesn't happen as much anymore because there is a lot more between surgeons, acute care physicians, primary care physicians, rehab folks, and then folks like Kyle who do the long-term stuff, and folks like us who do the community-based stuff. We're communicating more, so we're better prepared to help within that continuum of care.
Yeah.
Mark, I'm trying to go back through
my... She doesn't speak French anymore, by the way. Just so you know.
When did that stop? Mark, thank you, by the way, Mark, for the call. When did the French wear off?
It wore off right before she went to rehab. Yeah, and it is amazing.
It's an unbelievable thing.
Yeah, she spent 2 weeks in a Fulbright scholarship, I think. 2 weeks she was in France, but other than that, she really didn't speak French. So pretty remarkable story. The brain is an amazing thing. And we really don't know. I mean, every conference I go to, you know, there's some genius up there who's talking, and they're always the first to admit, we don't know a lot about the brain. We still don't after all these years, and it really is an amazing thing.
Well, but
an amazing computer, as Stephen Hawking would call it.
This is going to – I forgive the tangent that I'm about to go on here.
Sure.
But and with Paul's story about coming out and speaking French, it makes us think that – in our brains, I mean, they are such complex things that unlocking their potential. You've heard for years that the human beings only use 3% of our brains. I don't even really know what that's based on. One of the best movies ever made, though, is a movie called Defending Your Life. And Defending Your Life it's got to be 25 years old now. Albert Brooks, Meryl Streep. When you die,
are we aging ourselves by saying we know those that know it like it?
Yeah, right. And you go to Judgment City, and if you are determined to have lived a life generally with good decisions and without fear, you get to progress through the universe and you get to use more of your brain. That's the reward. Is that the problem? Is if you lose your trial in Judgment City, they send you back, you get reincarnated, and you have to go back to living with only 3% of your brain until you can move on through the universe. And Rip Torn plays the attorney, and he uses 49% of his brain, and he tells Albert Brooks, "You only use 3." I mean, there's no evidence, is there, that we're only? I don't know how you would. How did that myth come about that we only use 3% of our brain?
I'm not sure where that came from. It might have been an old tale.
It can't be right.
No, I mean, you know, your brain's the 3-pound universe that you have. I could probably get myself in trouble on this one. Well, it's a 3-pound universe, although males' brains weigh closer to 3 pounds and females weigh closer to 2.5 pounds. Now, usually when I lecture on this subject, I usually say, well, maybe females just get it done with less brain cells.
That's right.
And they're more efficient. But, you've got 100 billion cells, okay? Each neuron, which is the hub of the network within the brain, are capable of anywhere from 7 to 10,000 interconnections themselves. That's an amazing thing. It's more powerful, more complex than any computer that's been developed or that we've looked at. It is a chemical historian. We store memories so that we can pull those up, and memory allows us to be who we are. Our identity allows us to remember our loved ones, et cetera, and think about the diseases within brain injury or outside of traumatic brain injury where people begin to lose their memories and they lose who they are and, you know, grow too old to dream, as they say.
So, in other words, I mean, I understand the idea of coming out of a coma and speaking French is an amazing thing. It reminds us that our brains maybe can absorb and even subconsciously lock up all kinds of things, but it doesn't mean that we're only using 3%
or
5%.
No.
I've seen
no research that says that.
No. John in Rochester. John, thanks for calling the program. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Very good.
Hi, John.
Okay. I have a brain tip brainstem. I've had it since 97. I went through all the tests. I had an EEG. I had whatever else. I have CAT scans, MRI, something like that. There was something wrong in there. Okay, I'm getting Social Security disability since 98. The doctors at that time told me, don't stop moving. What were the comment on that?
Well, first of all, John, what did you say the affliction is? I missed it at the beginning.
A tipped brain stem.
A tipped?
Yes.
Brain stem.
Right. In other words, where the brain and the spine meets, it's not 100% together.
Okay. Okay. But the diagnosis was stay active. Well, you are teeing up a great point that we wanted to make sure we talk about this hour, John. And I already see Kyle Hauser of Hauser Associates nodding over there. Stay active, Kyle?
Use it or lose it. Yeah. I mean, just use it. Stay active. There's research to suggest that, anything from walking to other forms of aerobic activity, running, cycling, going to the gym on a stationary bike, any of those things have positive effects on the brain. Okay. So staying active is good. The opposite of that is true as well. Getting a good night's sleep is primary. In fact, one of the top three or four things that I see following brain injury is people who have a disrupted sleep cycle. And I mean, let's face it, I mean, if we have one night and we have to come to work and you have to be on and do all these things, sometimes it's a challenge. And so staying active, number one, I totally agree. And number two, making sure that you have a good night's sleep. Now, in terms of a tipped brain stem, I'm trying to go back through my memory bank here. There are a couple disorders that people are sometimes born with that can lead to that area of the brain that tends to be disrupted, but there's, and I'm wondering, in your case, was this trauma related?
I had an accident. The guy decided to hit me in the front of the truck, my front truck, with like a tool truck.
Yes.
Instead of waiting for me, where there's an eye in the road, I was going out to go into that lane. He was at the signal light. He saw me there. He just kept right on going. Didn't bother stopping.
Man.
And that was it. I got so much medicine because of this. You know, another thing, my neighbor next door about 5 years ago had an aneurysm. Mm-hmm. Now the doctor told him, to tell them, don't do nothing. He told him, know what he's doing? I told him when I saw him last, I said, I won't see you. At 6 months comes, I won't see you anymore.
Mm.
I said, because well, they won't let him get out. He's an active guy like I am. The doctors told me to cut the grasses. Plow the snow. Do everything you can do. Just keep going, because we don't know what your brain injury is going to do if something happens.
Yeah, one of the most important approaches to rehab is meaningful engagement. People engaging in things that are meaningful to them. And the mistake a lot of times we make as people who are providing help is that we're providing help that we think is good for the person. So, you know, we're trying to get you involved in activities that we think should be meaningful to you, whether it be going bowling or going swimming. And there are guys that we've worked with, Kyle and I both worked with, it's like, I have never been interested in bowling. I've never been interested in swimming. I've never been interested in any of these things. Because I've had a brain injury, what makes you think I'm interested now?
Right.
It's this kind of this common thing where we want
to tailor the activity to their interests.
Yeah. And I think we talk a lot about collaborative rehabilitation. And when you think collaborative, sometimes we as when people hear that word and providers hear that word, they think, okay, it's collaborating between providers. That's not what collaborative rehabilitation is. Collaborative rehabilitation is working with the individual and saying, what's important to you? Where do you want to go? How do you want to reconstruct your identity moving forward with your life? So, you know, what was your life before? What was it now? What's it going to be? And you have the power to be able to make those changes. And then I will define help with you, figuring out how can I help you get to that point. So it really is a in the past, we used to use kind of an expert patient model, whereas, okay, you have a brain injury, and now I say, okay, you know, John, you need to keep moving, or John, you need to not move, or John, you need to be involved in this or that. Really what we're doing is that we are taking the approach that the person is the expert on them. The person is the expert on somebody who has a brain injury and who might have impulsivity issues. Who better to talk about, you know, impulsivity than somebody who deals with it every single day of their lives? Mm-hmm. Who better to help establish a plan of treatment than the person who deals with it every day?
Yeah, I think of my wife's grandfather who died at 91. At 91 was super sharp. And I look back, I hear what Paul is saying, and I think about the fact that you know, he was a farmer. And he retired from farming, but he wanted to stay physically active. He was, you know, had a little creek near the home. He wanted to go down and build a little rock wall off it. And he wanted to be the one to cut the grass and do a lot of the landscaping stuff. And eventually, you know, sort of out of a good intention, some family members say, you know, you're 90, Einar. Do you need to be doing this and that? Yes, I do. And for us, we always thought, well, physically active for the body is a use it or lose it. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly, mm-hmm. you know, accurate. But what Paul and Kyle are saying is physically active for the body, if that's what you have been about and that's where your identity is still active for the brain.
Absolutely.
You bet. I oftentimes will ask a person within the first five times that I've met them, if I'm doing an evaluation, the question or the statement will come up, you know, what are your wishes, hopes, dreams, desires? Where do you see yourself in the next year, 2 years, 3 years? And initially, it doesn't even, for me, you know, as a consultant and therapist, it doesn't even make any difference if it seems realistic to me or not. That's what they're putting out there. I want to get my license back. I want to be able to drive again. I want to be able to hold my daughter. And it's really based upon their passions. And that's important for each and every one of us, brain injury or not.
Let me also say, John followed up and says he does have a headache 24 hours a day in the right temple and nothing has helped it. That's a hard situation, and we're all different. Certainly, they say the brains are like snowflakes. But how would you start to address? I'm sure John's already started to try, but how would you start to address that kind of an issue?
Well, number one, I'm assuming that John has a primary care physician, and if he's had a brain injury, he hopefully has a neurologist. And I would say following up with either one of those professionals would be your first. The first step, pain issues, whether they are headache oriented or pressure oriented in the brain, or other orthopedic injuries, other bone and type injuries that may have happened because of the quote unquote auto accident. Pain is something that we are continuing to learn more about as scientists. You know, what's interesting, pain is registered in the brain, but if we opened up our cranium and we touched the brain, we cannot feel that. So it's an amazing, amazing thing.
Wow, that is.
Yes, yeah, it is.
Pain management is so important, and it's so important to be able to communicate with your medical providers in an effective way to manage the pain. A lot of folks that we work with, if they don't get the help they need to manage the pain, they end up self-medicating. And that creates a whole sudden new set of problems.
Yes.
Because then you're dealing with substance abuse, sometimes addictions and things like that. A lot of folks with brain injury are very impulsive or might have executive functioning or decision-making difficulties after a brain injury. And so when in doubt, if I'm not getting the help I need or I feel resistance from my providers, I get what we call the screw-its. And I say, screw it. Can I say that on the radio?
You can.
Okay, I wasn't sure. Except sometimes we say something
else.
That's
a technical medical term.
It's a medical term. It's not in the DSM-IV yet, but we're working on
it.
But basically they say, to heck with it. I'm going to, you know, move on and deal with it myself. And then we have a couple of different problems. Now we have a whole bunch of psychosocial issues as a result of substance abuse.
And that's a dangerous situation.
It is.
Certainly is. Jake writes to the program and says, the brain's ability to adapt after an injury has for a very long time believed to decline as we age. But I've seen some recent studies that suggest it remains flexible much later in life than previously thought. Could your guest talk about that in the context of modern stroke treatment?
Well, there is the concept of what we call plasticity, that the brain is plastic or malleable or changeable or adaptive, which is, I think, the best term for that. And there's both bench science research as well as clinical research that looks at the whole idea of plasticity. When you think about it, that big word plasticity, it's really learning. If our brain wasn't able to change, we wouldn't be able to retain and store and be able to pull up those new learning, whatever they happen to be, whether it's relearning to walk, whether it is remembering birthdays, whether it is being able to play a violin if you played violin prior. Now, in terms of...
plasticity is just fun to say, Kyle.
Yes,
just,
it is.
It's
yes,
a fun
it,
word to
yeah,
say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good point, Paul. But in terms of stroke, that's certainly... that's well, depending on the type of strokes, a brain injury is more can be a more, from an auto accident, can be a more diffuse injury where it occurs everywhere within the brain. So sometimes when we talk about brain injury, we talk about diffuse injuries and we talk about focal injuries, okay? So a stroke in a certain area of the brain, depending on how far it
is
bleeds,
focal?
Could be focal, but if it goes unregulated, if you had an aneurysm that ruptured, then no. A focal injury, the classic focal injury would be a gunshot wound from a pistol anywhere in through the brain. It would be through and through, or if there was a projectile that went up into the brain.
Like an IED?
Like something that, say, Congresswoman Gabby Gifford suffered, a gunshot that went through the skull in the brain, and so we see some of the impacts there. Mm-hmm. That would be more focal,
yes.
We would assume. I mean, yes. Obviously we haven't seen the...
It would also depend on the immediate care that the person got and if they were able to control the secondary issues. Right, but yeah, so diffuse and focal would be the two types. Now, with back to our caller's question, in terms of stroke, it also depends upon the... it depends upon location. I often say brain injury and real estate have the same gig, location, location, location. But it also depends upon the age in which the person receives that stroke. I mean, there are infants that are born and have strokes very early on. I've had, and then later on in young adult life, I've had stroke, my youngest stroke patient, 26.
26,
yes. And so that's different than if somebody is 56 or 66. Certainly our ability to respond because of our age can affect it. However, there is, as the caller has alluded to, there is some research that just an aging brain doesn't necessarily mean that we're declining, okay? It depends on what you do with it, you know?
Right. Well, an important piece of this also is that the question you need to ask as a provider and as somebody going through it, guessing whether you still have this ability to learn and grow at a certain point is really going to change the way you move forward. I mean, the bottom line is that we're still going to help you and you're still going to want help. And so we still want to move forward as if you can, with the assumption that all people can learn and grow despite their disability, despite the nature of the injury, that we're still going to be moving forward with whatever kind of help you need.
My first day of work ever as a member of the broadcast television news industry happened to be on a day where the producer of the noon newscast that day, this is down in Charleston, West Virginia, had a stroke. She was 30. And I have no diagnosis from a medical perspective. I was told by people who knew her that her staff had thought, the medical treating staff had thought, it was related to birth control. And I don't know if that is, I certainly don't want to scare anybody, but at 30 years old, maybe are there other conditions in play maybe, or something that we didn't know? Have we heard of any relation at all to those things, Kyle? Paul?
From my reading, and again, I'm not a medical doctor, but from my reading, there are a small percentage of females who take birth control and may either have it may provoke migraine-type headaches, etc. I would say that generally there could be a pre-existing condition if it leads to stroke. Mm-hmm. There's a condition known as an AVM in the brain, and which is a long arteriovenous malformation. Just the input, what's bringing blood to the brain, and then the veins that are taking it away, sort of are malformed very, very early in development. And some people live their entire lives and die of something else. And then sometimes because of maybe size, et cetera, that takes place. I have had a case in the past where 6 days post-delivery from the first child, somebody stroked. So, yeah, so there's a lot of different possible issues there.
And again, let me stress.
Yes.
Do not let anybody in this listening audience be overly concerned about that relationship. That I only ask because anecdotally we had heard it. I am not a doctor, and I am not telling anyone to be concerned about birth control related to stroke. It was just sort of an interesting question that
That's
always been in the air there. We're going to get back to the phones in a moment. I'm way late for a break, but if you're on the line, we're coming to you next. And in studio, we have Kyle Hauser of Hauser Associates, Paul Akers of Epilepsy Prelude. It's our Dialogue on Disability. It's part of Dialogue on Disability Week. It's a partnership between WXXI and the Al Siegel Community of Agencies in conjunction with the Herman and Margaret Schwartz Community Series. Dialogue on Disability is supported in part by the Golisano Foundation, with additional support from the Fred L. Emerson Foundation. Break. Your calls and questions next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, our dialogue on disability continues in the first hour, and then we'll carry the governor's State of the State address live in our second hour. We'll preview it with Karen DeWitt, our Albany and Capital Bureau correspondent. We'll talk about the big themes that the governor is introducing on Wednesday. You can hear his words live in the State of the State. Join us for Connections on Wednesday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Doyle Subaru on Ridge Road in Webster, featuring symmetrical all-wheel drive vehicles for all-weather driving, including the 2015 Subaru Legacy. Doyle, serving the Rochester region for more than 70 years. More at doylesubaru.com.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. And Keith in Victor is next. Go ahead, Keith.
When talking about strokes, how often does the condition of anomia present itself?
I don't have a percentage on that.
Is it common? Because I've only heard of it, and I've only known of it on. I'm a volunteer EMT, and we get calls for strokes. I've only known one instance of it.
Yeah, I don't have a percentage on that from the literature right off the top of my head, you can have a variety of different things across the board that can occur, and you know, of course, especially where in the brain that bleed occurs. So. Very good question.
Anomic aphasia, is that the same thing? I'm trying to understand, Keith. Keith, I apologize. The amateur jumped in.
That's all right. I think I learned about this firsthand off of a listen to NPR on the national side. They were talking about head trauma, and they basically gave EMTs a really good plug because they're usually the first ones on scene, and you know they stress now for rapid transport. Help alleviate some of the symptoms.
Yeah, here you go. I'm sorry, Keith. I just want to make sure our listeners understand what Keith is talking about. Anomia is a deficit of expressive language, and the most pervasive deficit in the aphasias is anomia. I always think of aphasia when I think about there was a viral video clip a few years ago of a reporter in L.A. who was trying to do a live shot on television and all of a sudden started slurring and couldn't speak. She was having a migraine, which was associated with that aphasia, that bout of aphasia was associated with sort of a brain flare-up. It was a migraine. But anyway, that I think of aphasia. Anomia is a deficit of language. I hope we're talking about the same thing, right, Keith?
Well, the way I look at it is if you show a patient a pen and they say, oh, do you know what this is? And they say a pen, and then you say, do you know what it's used for? And they don't know.
Or can't express it, or can't say...
Right, or something like that.
Yeah.
But the two aren't connecting. We know there's some sort of brain issue.
Yeah, Keith, thank you for the call. It's a very interesting question, and it makes me go back to the question or the point that Kyle was raising on location, location, location. Is there a better or more fortunate part of the brain to have an injury in? I mean, this is all a relative term because no one wants a brain injury, but are there parts of the brain that are going to be less of an impact?
I wouldn't want to say that. I guess some people say, wow, you know, I've never been very impulsive in my life. I want to take more risks. So a right frontal lobe brain injury seems to be something I want.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think it's important that we have a good idea of where generally, if somebody has like right frontal lobe injury, we know that chances are they're going to be a little bit impulsive or more impulsive than they were before. Left frontal lobe is going to be, you know, have some initiation difficulties. But what's important to know also is that it's not just location. Part of it's pathways as well, is that your brain is kind of interconnected. And so sometimes you might have a, you know, you might have an injury in a location that interrupts a pathway, just that, you know, sends something that's sending messages from one part of the brain to the other. So we need to be careful about location, from what I've experienced, at least. Kyle, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree. Because, and here comes the your favorite word there, Paul, plasticity. Okay, so if there's a stroke and that area of the brain dies out, the way that rehabilitation works is by doing things, getting up and learning to walk again and doing that a lot and more efficiently, learning to talk and think in certain ways, you end up not necessarily repairing that area that's damaged. You end up networking around it, and that's right. The whole idea of plasticity.
Right. And that's an important piece of rehabilitation, is that procedural learning is usually intact after a brain injury, you know, pretty much no matter where the injury is. More often than not, we have two kinds of memory. We have our procedural memory and we have our declarative memory. Declarative memories, you know, pulling out dates and names and things of that sort. Our procedural memories is stuff that we do when we practice. And it's really important that people have an opportunity to find something that's important to them and practice a skill over and over again with coaching, to be able to relearn these skills. And I think that goes back to what Kyle was saying about, you know, the brain rewiring itself, if you will.
Ellen in Fairport, we're coming to you in just a moment here, so hang in there. But let me follow up and just ask, because we're talking about location, I mentioned that a good friend of mine had a traumatic brain injury in 2003. She is one of the smartest people I know, and always was growing up and certainly still is. With her injury, when you meet her, you may think that maybe she is deaf. She has a monotonic voice, mm-hmm. and speaks very slowly and with great effort. Mm-hmm. But you know, when you communicate via email or online with her, she's sharper than she's ever been. So the part of her brain that was injured, obviously, among other things, impacted her speech, which I know can be common. Mm-hmm. But then you see someone like Bob Woodward, the ABC News anchor who was injured, and his speech is not essentially impacted. So I have always thought of brain injuries, and maybe this is wrong, as a part of the brain is injured, that part of the brain has died. You cannot bring back that part of the brain. You learn to function in other ways. I don't know if that's correct or not, and I don't know if that relates to speech or not.
Go ahead.
Let me take, okay, gotcha. Okay,
you can
I'll take
that one.
Okay. Well, in terms of speech, our expressive speech comes in the latter part. If you were to reach up and touch your temple, there's an area called Broca's area, and that's where speech production is, okay? And then there's a sort of a fissure from there, and our understanding area is just on the other side, and that's called Wernicke's area, and there's connections between those areas. So speech production, likely your friend had some difficulties in that area. You also referenced Bob Woodward, where you know, he had his was a as a correspondent in the war. And if you recall the first several times I saw him on air, his speech was slow and methodical, and he has become much more he's been able to gain a little bit more back than I thought that he would, just by when I saw him the first several times on air.
Yeah, he's done
quite well.
He's a little more deliberate, but his
yes.
his what are the proper terms? Tone and pitch and whatever makes your voice
yes.
is essentially still there.
Yes.
Whereas my friend who suffered this injury, mm-hmm. that is gone. Mm-hmm. It is a monotone expression
right.
that cannot regain that. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, mm-hmm. in some ways, she has rehabbed her speech to a form
right.
of now being able to converse pretty comfortably with people. It takes time, but she does it, and I'm amazed with her. She's an amazing, amazing woman.
Cool.
But that voice that she had is essentially gone, and now it's been replaced by a monotone. Mm-hmm. So I guess, again, every brain is going to respond differently to where the injury is, where it's localized.
And it could have been where exactly within and around where Broca's area was. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people's voices altered depending on the accident, and did they have a cut down here and a stone, you know, a breathing tube put in at the base of their neck? That can actually give them a hoarse quality, a more hoarse or gravelly mm-hmm. quality to mm-hmm. the voice. There's likely some other areas, that are different there compared to the Bob Woodward.
Paul, anything to add there?
I think you're right. I think there are times when you're going to, because of the nature of the injury, sometimes it's going to be beyond repair, and you're going to need to find ways to adapt. And that's why we're on here, is that we want to help people adapt regardless. So if you need to start using a Dynavox, or you find other ways to be able to communicate or educate people on how you communicate, things of that sort, that's important. So we don't want to, you know, keep doing the same thing over and over again and try to, you know, work on inflections in your voice if that's not going to come back. But at the same time, we want to find ways for you to engage meaningfully on how to communicate. What does that look like for you?
One of our listeners on Twitter writes, I was told since I had preeclampsia twice that I'm at a higher risk for stroke now. Anything I can do to prevent it? I don't know if that's
a really good medical question, and probably a little bit out of my expertise. Of course, I do know that preeclampsia can, you know, with, you know, your higher blood pressure, et cetera, can certainly put you at risk. I don't know. I would say that you'd really have to follow up with your doctor on that. But right. From my reading, your call or your Twitter, your tweet there, mm-hmm. She's right on.
Yeah. Let me get back to the phones. This is Ellen in Fairport. Go ahead, Ellen.
First of all, let me say thank you so much for the kind of show that puts collaboration out front, and love the approach that people that we work with are the experts. I work with the brain in a little bit different capacity and have really enjoyed this show today. But I come on the other side of a couple of issues very briefly. The 3 pounds for a guy, 2.5 possibly for a woman. I used to write a column for Mensa, and I've been working with brain for about 40 years, so that was quite a few years ago. But I wrote one column with the title Bigger is Better, and then went on to explain that the elephant's brain is 25 pounds. So there we have that one. But,
that's good. That's good perspective.
I've really enjoyed some of the comments on and have come to realize, listening to you gentlemen, that it's often semantics, and the exciting part now is that there are so many people weighing in on brain facts from so many angles. I work with a doctor in Europe who said, look, I can take out your brain and massage it tomorrow, but I can't do what you do in learning in higher ed and how this works and some of the strategies you use. And what I thought was so humbling about that statement is that we need many fields weighing in on the amazing proliferation of knowledge about the brain. One, for example, when we say, it's so easy to be polemic and say, oh, we don't use 3% of our brain. I would join that camp really quickly over a camp that says we're using all we have. Why? Just very briefly, an example. You talked delightfully about the kinesthetic brain and how this grandfather in his 90s used the movement, used kinesthetic intelligence. Bob Smith and I, on this same program, talked one time about the wonder of multiple intelligences used with adults, and that triggers plasticity and builds new neuron pathways. So if you're not using your kinesthetic and you're hopping around at 80, you are not using much capacity that you could be using. If you stress yourself out and cortisol floods your brain, much of the operational parts will shut down when you need to use them. So I think it's semantics often. I loved the show today. I've learned so much, and I especially appreciate the open-mindedness and collaborative approach.
Ellen, thanks for the call.
Well,
great stuff.
Thank
and,
you.
And for any listeners who missed it earlier, Paul, one more time, tell us about exactly what she means when she says collaborative approach.
Collaborative approach basically means that you're collaborative with the patient. It's not an expert-patient model. It's a partnership, if you will. So we are working with the individual knowing that they're the expert on what it's like to deal with the symptoms that they're dealing with, whether it be impulsivity, whether it be executive functioning, even if it's social stuff like, you know, my mom, now that I've had a brain injury, my mom treats me like I'm a 5-year-old. And that really sucks for me. Can I say that? It really stinks for me.
You can say because you've heard it, haven't you?
Yes. Well, the language is the language is usually a little harsher
even
than
harsher
that.
Harsher than that.
Because it is very frustrating because the assumption are, I think the natural response for a lot of folks who are helpers and see people with disabilities that they want to help, and then we end up over helping. And we end up over-caring. And we used to talk about the spitty hanky mom. You know, it's just like we want to help so much that we impose our help on folks, which becomes very frustrating for individuals sometimes. And then sometimes we think they're being oppositional when in reality they just want more control of their lives, because a lot of folks after a brain injury, the biggest thing that they lose more than most anything else is their sense of control over their own lives. Mm-hmm. And so if we're collaborating and we help them take control of, okay, where do you want to go and how do I help you get there? Mm-hmm. You're driving this train. If we can help them around that, then they're less stressed. They're more motivated. It's more meaningful for them to go where they want to go in terms of rehab.
Mm-hmm. I oftentimes refer to, at critical junctures in therapy, I'm just a pilgrim on the road with you, okay? And, we need to team up on this. Sometimes I'm coach, sometimes I'm shaman, sometimes I'm priest, sometimes I'm therapist, but I'm always just a human being on the road, as a pilgrim.
So a friend of ours who's Dr. Tim Feeney, who's kind of an expert in this world, and Dr. Mark Ovesacker, they used to talk about the difference between a coach and a nag. Mm-hmm. And a nag was somebody that was just harping on you to get you to do something that they wanted you to do. And a coach is somebody, as Walt Harris said, is somebody who gets you to do something you don't want to do to become the person you want to be.
That's right.
And that's the role we really try to take.
Well, this community is fortunate to have the rich resources it does, and we've learned so much this hour from Paul Akers, the VP of Community Services for Epilepsy Prelude. Paul, great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having us.
Bonjour, and how do you say au revoir? A little French.
My
brain couldn't even access today. Kyle Hauser of Hauser Associates. Thanks, Kyle.
Thank you, Evan.
And a reminder, today's connection is part of the Dialogue on Disability Week. It's a partnership between WXXI and the Al Siegel Community of Agencies in conjunction with the Herman and Margaret Schwartz Community Series. Dialogue on Disability is supported in part by the Golisano Foundation, with additional support from the Fred L. Emerson Foundation. This is Connections. Thanks for listening. I'm Evan Doss.